morning out there, everybody. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer, your guest host for today's one-hour special program. I don't know if it's special or not. That's the goal, I guess, to make it special every week. It's my unique opportunity to be here with you this week, this month. It's my first time here in June, but we should be able to get back on here again in June for myself. But I am a doctor of chiropractic. I also have a couple of advanced certifications or board certifications in a couple of disciplines, including chiropractic acupuncture as well as clinical nutrition. I am the only board certified clinical nutritionist actively taking new patients at Take Two Healthcare. And I did a little searching this morning. I wanted to see, and I thought I could remember the statistic, but I didn't remember it. And what I was looking for was how many of my chiropractic brethren out there. There's 70,000 of us in the United States that are licensed chiropractors. And I wanted to know how many of the licensed chiropractors in the U.S. held specialty status or board certification in a particular discipline. In the chiropractic world, in our chiropractic profession, there are 17 different specialty degrees leading towards board certification. And I wanted to just take a really quick minute to kind of cover that with you. And my quick online search said there's no exact stat for how many chiropractors hold multiple board certifications, but the expectation is that the number is quite small. I've seen it written in other publications between 6 and 10% of our 70,000 licensed chiros in the U.S. hold one board certification. I have two, and this is not a brag fest. This is just to tell you I've put in a lot of hours studying and studying different disciplines so that I can help more people. I mean, because ultimately that's why I got into this profession in the first place. I want to help people. Okay. Some people come in, I don't necessarily love helping them, but it's my job and I love my job. So I will do whatever it takes within reason, following the letter of the law and not putting my license in jeopardy to help these patients if they seek my help. I will. And I've done that for 21 years, and I want to keep doing it another 21 more. But in my chiropractic acupuncture practice, in my clinical nutrition practice, and in my just regular old chiropractic practice, I have three different ways, or three different, you could say, modalities or specialties or ways of looking at and assessing the body to figure out how we can help you the most. And so if that's kind of where you find yourself this week or this month or this year, I think if you've been a returning listener to this program, you kind of already know what our philosophy on health tends to sound like. We use food and we use nutritional supplementation in our blood and hair and urine testing practice. So in our clinical nutrition practice, the first thing we usually do is order a set of tests on patients. And so those tests might include some 58 different blood markers. There's panels we run on cancer detection and heart assessment. So advanced coronary panels or advanced cardiac panels, we call them. There's hormone panels that we do. And all that is not just because we love to order tests. Well, yes, we do love to order tests, but the tests help give us the information that we need in order to help a patient. If you go in to see your primary care physician, and you might see them once a year, once every 2 years, once every 6 months, depends on what you've got going on, and they order a blood test on you, you'll be lucky to see about 15 or 18 different blood markers on your assessment. When you come and see us for a blood test, we're going to run about 58 markers. And that gives us a broader view into how healthy your body is. And it doesn't only just give us that broader view, it helps us to put you kind of on a continuum of if 0 to 80 is what the medical community says you need to be considered normal, quote unquote, in the normal range, somewhere between, I guess, 1 and 80, because most numbers aren't going to come back at 0. But our healthy range runs from 25 to 60. Then we've got to put together a plan on how to get you there. And so the remainder of our hour together today is going to be me kind of giving you some ideas on how to assess certain conditions and then how to treat or help those conditions. And I gave a lecture a couple of weeks back at the University of Dayton. And it was in their Udalee program. They're lifelong learning, and it's for people age 50 and older, 55 and older, one of those age cutoffs and up. So, you know, retired folks and people kind of on that verge of that phase of their life. And I spoke for 4 hours over two different Tuesday nights. And what I set out to do was give people background on not only how we practice the way we practice, but give them opportunities on how to learn what to do to make themselves healthier. And so I actually got some feedback from some of those that were in my class this week. And 9 out of 11, now there was more than that, but 9 out of 11 that filled out their survey said they would come back and listen to me talk again. So I'll take that as a positive. It was the other two that'll probably haunt me for the next 10 years. Because I began my 4 hour lecture with just some background on me, my training, how we practice, the way we practice. And I say we because there's three doctors in our office. It's not just me. But one lady was particularly upset that I wasn't helping her solve her unique health problem during my lecture. And I guess she thought that based on the syllabus and the title of my course, which was Clinical Nutrition Applications for Today's Modern Epidemics, and those were diabetes, cancer, and then cognitive decline conditions like Alzheimer's, dementia, and the like. And so I kind of divided the talk into 1 hour segments on those three big topics. But I started the first hour with kind of a broad overview of how we do what we do. And I had handouts for dietary practices, different sample menu plans, and what to avoid in your diet. And I thought I was giving a lot of good broad information because the only way to get really specific with it is to test a patient. And okay, so then her knock on me in the lecture was that I talked far too much about tests that were too expensive to get done, and then I was going to make her take too many pills, and she wasn't interested in that approach. And that is okay. But everyone else in the class, and there were nearly 40 people, everyone else in the class kind of knew what to expect and understood what the syllabus said and then followed along with me for the next 4 hours. We did 2 hours that night and 2 hours the next week. And so it was really a fun experience in a lot of ways. But typically when I go out and give a lecture in the community, if somebody has me come in and speak to a group, or I go and do a talk at one of the health food stores, or, you know, give a talk at the clinic, I usually start out by introducing people to the method of the method to our madness, which is, you know, utilizing clinically relevant testing to help figure out where somebody's body is at any point in time so that we can attempt to make it better. Because if you went in again to see your standard medical physician, they're going to order tests, right? I mean, if you come in and you got coughing and you're spitting up yellow and green stuff, they're probably not just going to take one little look down your throat and say, oh, you've got a sinus infection and here you go out the door. Sometimes they do, but they're going to want to order on at least a minimal level a CBC, a complete blood count, to see if you indeed have infection. Is it an acute infection? Is it chronic infection? Is it driven by environmental allergies, perhaps? Or is it even a food sensitivity that you're dealing with? There's so many little quick things that can be done with just a simple CBC test. And sometimes that's what we order on our patients too, to check and make sure they are getting better after we put them on a course of care for maybe 60 days. And then as I was kind of going through more of the feedback that I got from my presentation at UD, one of the last little taglines from a happy customer, if you'll say, she said, well, not everybody believes in the pill approach to health. And I was kind of reflecting on that over the course of the week, thinking, you know, I think that's true. And I'm not sure that I ever really promoted the pill to health approach. But what I was trying to get people to understand is, if you want to get in or need to get in somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 milligrams of vitamin C every day, you can think your way through eating oranges and broccoli to get there, but you're going to have to eat way more oranges and broccoli than your stomach and body can take in a day to get to 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C. If your average orange contains somewhere between 40 and 50 milligrams, that's a whole lot of oranges to get you up to 3,000. It's probably not going to do your blood sugar any favors. So while I understand her knock or her criticism of what I was saying, it was really more about the understanding that in our current time of modern farming and really over-farming in a lot of ways, we've depleted the soil of essential nutrients. Therefore, our foods don't contain those essential nutrients to even the same high percent degree that they had 20, 30 years ago. And now we're thinking, oh, if I eat a really good, clean, natural, organic, whole food diet, I can give my body everything it needs. Well, another good example is vitamin D. If you're going to count on your food and the sunshine to give you enough vitamin D3 to bring your blood levels up to, say, at least 32 or higher, which is the medical cutoff for quote-unquote healthy. Ours is 50 or higher, just for those playing along at home. But the goal with that would be, or how are you going to do that with food? One egg, the yolk of an egg, contains only 40 IUs of D3. And if you want to get 5,000 in a day, how can you eat 100 eggs? I know those of you out there are going, oh my gosh, your cholesterol will be off the charts. No, eggs are not the reason for your cholesterol going high. But I don't recommend you eat 100 in a day. I sometimes eat 2 or 3 in a day, sometimes 4 to 6 in a day. It depends on the day. Depends on how many different meals I'm going to have that could contain an egg. And a lot of times I'm adding eggs here and there where I can. But it's not going to get me to D3 levels that are sufficient above 50. I want to take you into a patient that I saw this week. Into her blood results, we'll say that. She is a longtime patient. She's a survivor of cancer from back in 2009. She was not my patient during that run, but shortly thereafter, we got acquainted with each other. She's currently 66 years old, and she is otherwise healthy now. She has a few challenges from the treatments she went through back in the day for cancer treatment, but she's mostly healthy. She loves being a grandma. She gets to travel with her grandkids all the time. And she was concerned about a family history of Alzheimer's and dementia. So we did a blood test on her called p-tau-217. If you have not yet heard me talk about p-tau-217 on this program, welcome to today's program where we're going to talk about p-tau-217. And what that test detects at an 88 to 92% specifically accurate rating is the potential of that patient to develop Alzheimer's at some point in the future. Yes, it's a predictive value, but what it's measuring is tangled tau proteins that are synonymous with amyloid plaque formation, and that is the hallmark pathology in Alzheimer's and dementia cases. So we measured this level on her. We measured it on the 9th of January, just this past year. So we're looking like 5 months ago now. And the clinically acceptable number here would be to be have a value below 0.18. Well, her value the first time came back at 0.34. So almost twice as high as it should be based on that clinical range, which is an even broader range than the healthy range we use to categorize where she's at. Good news for her. 4.5 months down the road, I actually got these blood test results in my office this week. She might not even have them back yet. And hopefully she's listening because she's going to be excited about the result. That number dropped from 0.34 down to 0.20. Remember, the cutoff for clinical is 0.18, meaning we're only 0.02 points. So within ones, tens, hundreds, we're within 0.02 of a point of having her back to where that clinically acceptable category begins. Now, we wouldn't want to stop there. Actually, for our healthy range, we want her down around 0.04. So we need another big reduction in the next 6, 8, 12 months. We probably won't come back to the number again for about a year's time now. But knowing that, we have the capabilities of helping her get this number addressed simply by using clinical nutrition solutions. And I know everybody out there, oh my gosh, what'd you give her? That's what you want to know. Well, I had her on a program specifically designed for her. So her program is going to be different than the next program that comes in or the next person that comes in, even with the same type of numbers and background. Sure, there's some commonalities. We definitely use fish oil in this case. We're definitely using a nutrient called Brain Sustain from Zymogen, a great product that works wonderfully to help protect those delicate neural pathways in the brain and actually to help heal a brain that has, I'm not going to say damaged because we're not talking about a brain damaged patient. We're talking about a patient that has tangled tau proteins laying down. So I kind of bring this analogy. We got to take a break. I'm just getting wound up, but this is good. We'll come back after a break. You're listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer on Take Two Healthcare on WHIO, AM 1290 and News 95.7. We'll be back right after this. And we're rolling back in. Thank you, Dalton. We are back live. This is Dr. Andrew Dyer here with you this morning. And I'm looking for something here really fast in a report that I wanted to share with you. It's going to have to be later. Okay, I'll find it for you. But I wanted to share, again, just a few more quick thoughts on the p-tau217 value that we were talking about on the other side of the break. And I was chatting with Dalton about this at the break, and he said, you know, I thought Alzheimer's was something, once you found out you had it, you couldn't really do that much about it. And I think that was the long accepted answer, and still is to a degree on the medical side. And I'm not saying I have more knowledge or more information than many of the world's experts on this condition. But I think if you're looking at it simply from a, what kind of pill could they offer me in my medical doctor office to reverse or help Alzheimer's, there's only a few options. And some of them come with really significant side effects. And what their expectation is they just kind of make the condition flat in terms of its spikes, peaks, and valleys, if you will, on symptoms. If they can kind of level off that brain deterioration, then the patient can last longer in that state. But if we can do some more gathering of test cases over these coming decades, where we can document change, especially in a third-party lab test, I don't have any personalized interest in the outcome of this test, and I don't have any way to influence it other than to give the patient the right treatment options. Like, I can't make the test different other than by giving the patient the right treatment. So I don't have the ability to push down harder on their arm to assess the strength of their right deltoid muscle in a way to say, the brain is now better. That's a very subjective test. I'm interested in objective testing. Blood lab testing, testing of the urine, testing of the hair analytes for toxicities, looking at urine challenges where we use a particular substance to pull metals out of the body through that mode of treatment. And in doing that, if we can make a person healthier, then the question that we have hanging on our wall in the office is, if we get the patient healthy, does it really matter the name of their diagnosis? Because if you applied that theory, that statement, that mantra, if you will, to any diagnosis, whether it's cancer, diabetes, MS, lupus, Alzheimer's, dementia, you name or throw out a condition at me, chronic fatigue syndrome, I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes. If you named any condition out there for me and then asked me, well, do you have experience treating this? Most of the time it's yes, because 21 years in, if you haven't been very busy, then you haven't seen all these conditions. But yeah, we've seen them all. And they're not all the same. Not every patient diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia is going to have a p-tau value that comes back perfect the first time, or comes back even crazy high the first time, because we're not just looking at that one test score. Now, I know that's what I talked about today, but that was for the sake of being brief on this program to give you an idea that there are things we can do to impact these blood numbers. Now, a friend of mine last night, we were talking about what the show topics might be for the day. She said, well, what about inflammation? And she's long been requesting me to talk about this, and I know we got another break coming up, but then right after that, the first goal after the break is through is we're going to talk about inflammation and another kind of new word that I've given to you here before on the program. It's called inflammaging, which is inflammation and aging tied together. We're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. So stay with us. You're listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning on... Thank you very much. Dr. Andrew Dyer here. I want to get right into our topic of inflammaging, which we're going to do, but I forgot to remind folks at the beginning of the program, if you want to call and ask a question, the phone number to call here at the studio is area code 937-957-1290. I am here live today, so be happy to take your call. But before that happens, let's talk about inflammaging. So if any of these conditions sound familiar, I'm going to rattle off a couple, so pay close attention. Fibromyalgia pain, chronic joint pain, chronic fatigue, weight gain, anxiety or depression, cognitive decline, rising blood pressure, rising triglycerides and or cholesterol, and either hypoglycemia or elevated blood sugar, which is called hyperglycemia. If any of those conditions sound familiar, the problem may be, at the very root level, an issue of inflammation. And typically these inflammatory changes really take hold in the gut of the patient. Okay, so we're going to talk about a few statistics around guts, because it's an immune system harbor. It also is one of our very first lines of defense, right? When we put food in our mouth, the chewing and the saliva begin to help digest whatever it is we're eating, whether that's a liquid or it's a food that we're chewing. That chewing action starts to help digest and break down the food. We have certain enzymes in our mouth from the bacteria that live in there. And yes, some of those bacteria, if they overrun the system, they're the cause for bad breath and other problems in the teeth. It could be from sinus infection. There's all sorts of reasons behind why breath is bad. And it's not just skipping a toothbrushing. That is sometimes the cause. But a lot of times it's a gut-related problem where the good bacteria are being obliterated from some particular pathology or some reason. So consider these facts. More than 70% of your immune system resides in the lining of your intestinal tract and is activated from there by your what we call microbiota or microbiome of the gut. And what does that mean? That means all the little bugs, all the little bacteria, even good parasites, good fungi. We have all these things living in our gut tract. I know for some that's just overwhelming to think about, but that's how the body works. And through good diet, through good supplementation, we can cause these things to grow stronger and better and become more efficient at their jobs. Or if we're taking certain things that are kind of quote unquote poisoning that system of the body, then the outcome is not as good. So the microbiota contains 10 times as many bacterial cells as the number of human cells present in your body. So think about that for a second. 10 times the amount of bacterial cells are present in your gut when compared to all the other cells in the rest of your whole body. Incredibly, there are 100 times the number of microbiota genes in your body than human genes. So meaning all the little genetic coding snippets inside these bugs and bacteria, there's 100 times more of those than in all the human genes of our body. If you spread out flat the surface area of the human gut, it would cover a tennis court. So we're talking like 3,000 square feet. Okay, that'd be kind of a weird science experiment, but somehow they measure that all out based on the proximity of the gut, how long it is, all the curves and all the folds. And if you just spread that out and tried to cover a tennis court, you could do it with every single human walking around. Okay, not babies. They're too small. But an adult patient. Your gut contains at least 500 to 1,000 different species. And a recent analysis involving multiple subjects suggests that the collective human microbiome is composed of, ready for this number, over 35,000 bacterial species. So research is also showing us that there are direct communication pathways originating from all those little, what my favorite pathology teacher in Chicago called them, wee beasties. The wee beasties, she called them. Those little tiny bacteria that we need in our gut control how the gut talks to the brain, how the gut talks to the hypothalamus, which is another component of the brain up in the front that is in charge of regulating hormone output, cortisol, and beyond. There's now a gut-liver access that we've known about. So the gut and the liver are working back and forth. We've long known about this, but these words are coming to be more understood in layman's terms. Gut adipose access, so the amount of fat tissue that you have hanging out in your body, not just visceral fat surrounding your organs, but how much of that squeezy fat you can grab when you pinch by your hip or pinch by your rump. Those areas are adipose tissue. And there's a connection there between the good gut bacteria and the stored fat in the body. There's a gut pancreas access, a gut muscle access, and of course, a gut immune system access. I had a couple patients reach out to me this week about skin problems. And I really enjoy taking care of skin problems because most of the time it's not the skin's fault. It's a gut problem. Almost every time when I've been successful at helping a patient treat a skin problem, except if it's an acute outbreak of, say, they get involved in poison ivy out in their yard, they're clearing brush, and now they got poison ivy on them, that's not a gut problem. That's an acute toxicity of the skin. That's a skin problem. But even supporting the gut at that point can help them get better faster. And so what do I mean when I say supporting the gut? Well, I'm talking about using a good probiotic supplement, but not every probiotic works for every person. And so testing is important, and also kind of trialing and moving through different probiotics. Like, say for 1 month, you're taking a complement of 4 billion different cell types all across the board, 10 different kinds of good bacteria in there. And then the next month you might go to a Espilardi type probiotic that has 4 or 5 different strains than the month before that you were taking. Because if we know there's 500 to 1,000 different species down there, it doesn't make sense to just give yourself one version for the rest of time. We want to change that up so the body can get the most benefit, right? Even on the list, when we talked about chronic fatigue, hundreds of studies from the research literature link chronic fatigue to the word that I gave you before, inflammaging. That word inflammaging can be initiated by inflammation in the gut wall. What about weight gain? Those of you out there taking Ozempic or trying the natural version Berberine, you're probably not going to get the best results possible until you address the gut. And I'm not promoting the use of Ozempic, far from it. I think it's a terrible idea for long-term health for most people. Now, there's a couple people I've seen around walking around town that have lost a third or two-thirds of their body, but they could have done it a different way. I'm down about 18 or 19 pounds this year, and I haven't taken Ozempic or Berberine. Neither one. I wouldn't even consider taking Ozempic ever. Now, Berberine, I have patients ask me about that one all the time, too, because it's been promoted as this natural alternative to Ozempic. It's not. You take all the Berberine under the sun, and it's an herb, so you got to be careful. You can overdo it. And I don't even know the dosage on Berberine because I don't use it. You can look up the dose online. I'm not going to tell you what the dose would be because I don't know. I don't need to know. I've got 10, 15, 20 different options that are probably better in terms of more effective at helping to control blood sugar, which another promoted use for Berberine is. It's often promoted in the natural literature for headache sufferers, diabetic patients, and for weight loss. I've seen it be most effective in some patients that have come in on it before they've ever met or consulted with me for headaches. But typically headache patients are going to be much more complex than missing one herb in their diet. And there's not really a good way to ingest berberine in a safe manner other than taking it in a capsule. You're not going to go out and make a berberine salad. That's not how it works. But there are some really good options on what to do to target this gut function. And then by getting the gut healthier, what can that ultimately do for the rest of our body? So abdominal weight gain cannot be fully and permanently controlled without restoring a healthy microbiota via symbiotic supplementation, meaning those things I was talking about before. Maybe 1 month we are using Espilardi, the next month we're using a different probiotic. We carry 2 or 3 of them in the office, and I often go back and forth in my own usage of these things. I took 2 this morning. I typically take them at night before bed. There's mixed reviews and results in the literature on whether or not you benefit most from taking a probiotic on an empty stomach or not. Some people don't like to take anything on an empty stomach because it makes them a little bit nauseous or churny in the belly for a little while. I don't notice that from most of the nutrients I take. If I do take them on an empty stomach, I'm careful which ones I use on an empty stomach because most of the time we want people eating something because a lot of what we're going to give them is going to be easier to digest and absorb once the body starts breaking down the food that's in there too. Then the supplements can get broken down and out to where they need to go. What about emotional instability, cognitive decline, elevated blood pressure? Can we tie it all back to inflammatory changes? Well, the literature seems to think so. Inflammation is a process I think often overlooked in the ability to get somebody back to being healthy again we have to be able to notice patterns of improvement under inflammatory blood marker assessment. And I'm going to give you a couple of those major blood markers that we look at along this line. And those are as follows. The ESR, or the SED rate, it's often called the Westergren SED rate, but it's the ESR marker, standard blood test. A lot of medical doctors do it too. If you're being assessed for inflammation, that'll definitely be part of what they look at. C-reactive protein. There's a cardio-specific version too, depending upon what type of inflammation you're wanting to explore there. Homocysteine is one that we don't use on a regular basis, but it's not an expensive test. I think it probably costs the patient $30-$40 to assess their homocysteine levels. And that's often linked with an inverse relationship between B12 and B9. So as B9 and B12 levels are coming down, often connected and tied into chronic fatigue diagnoses, we see homocysteine levels climb. And so when homocysteine levels come back high on a blood test, what becomes the natural treatment option for that? Give the patient the right amount of B9 and B12 because they can do a lot better. And we can test and find out how we did in 2 to 3 months. We can do it faster than that. We can do it in a month if you want to see it that quickly. But typically we need about 60 to 90 days on that level of supplementation from B9 and B12. Why? Because in that period of time, about every 2 to 3 months, your body completely turns over all the red blood cells that are in there. So whatever blood cells that you have that are red today on the 6th of June, you're going to have a whole new set by September 6th, or roughly, okay? 60 to 90 days, we know that's the turnover cycle or life cycle of a red blood cell. And so if we give B9 and B12 for that length of time, we can make an impact. Now, you could start to see the impact happening even before that because not all the red blood cells die at the same time. If that were the case, we'd be in deep trouble. You know, the body has a recycling system in there where it's kind of gently grabbing some of the dying off ones and getting them out to the waste product division so that they can be excreted through urine, stool, sweat. I mean, yeah, those are all the excretory pathways. Most commonly for red blood cells, it's going to be through the urine, actually, when they're broken down and they're excreted that way. If you're getting red blood cells in through the stool, that's a bit of a problem. That's pathologic for a number of things. The easiest one to make sure of it not being would be hemorrhoids. Another patient that reached out to me this week and said, what do I do about these? He said, I'm seeing my medical physician next week. And I said, well, that's a good idea. But while you're waiting, you can use things like bromelain, curcumin complex, and actually there's very good acupuncture protocols to help ease the pain from hemorrhoids. If you think of it, this is an energetic problem where some of the tissues of the body have dropped through the bottom end of the digestive tract. The point to treat it is located on the very top of the skull. It's governing vessel 20, Ba Hui, is the name of the point in Mandarin. My Mandarin's no good, so if you're a natural Mandarin speaker, apologize for my pronunciation. But GV20, the point on the very top of the head, is a standalone treatment for hemorrhoids. Is it going to change the anatomy? No, it's not going to change the anatomy. But is it going to ease the pain that this patient's suffering with until he gets in to see his doctor next week? Yes. I don't usually deal with hemorrhoids in my office, but I can give some good supportive options on how the patient can ease their pain while they're getting through a tough weekend, maybe. And there's other things. There's sitz baths, and there's a whole bunch of different natural remedies for hemorrhoids. But that wasn't the design of what I wanted to talk about today anyway. So we're going to take another break. And after that, if we got some callers to get to, we will. If not, we'll come up with a few more topics for you here at the end of the program. So stay tuned. We're going to be back with more on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO. And we're back. We got a couple minutes to rock with just here to get you to the end of the program. And you're with listening to Dr. Andrew Dyer this morning for Take Two Healthcare, your guide to better living. And we talked about so many different cool, hopefully fun and educational topics. Hopefully you took something away from this program. We did review current blood testing as acceptable for screening for dementia and Alzheimer's cases, other forms of neurological decline. And I told you before that I wanted to just give you a little background on what that number really means when we test it. And that was p-tau-217 is generally superior to CSF tests, so cerebrospinal fluid. That's another very painful way to collect information from someone's body as opposed to just taking a blood test. But That p-tau217 is generally superior to CSF tests in classification of brain pathology associated with Alzheimer's disease, cognitive impairment, and dementias. The amyloid plaque, p-tau217 and p-tau181, can be used to facilitate biological identification, similar to PET scan and CSF, to detect Alzheimer's disease, dementias, neurological decline, and brain atrophy at the earliest possible time and to slow the course of disease. That's really where it comes in super handy, is figuring out, one, if the patient has this problem. Yes, that's part of it, but really being able to use it as a marker going forward toward the future to see if we're in fact making a positive improvement on that value. And there's quite a few different approaches that are needed to at least be considered with each individual patient, because even if the diagnosis is the same, we don't treat every patient that has that diagnosis in the exact same manner, because they're different sizes. They've got other comorbidities or different problems going on. Maybe they have diabetes, or they have liver problems, or there's thyroid problems. So not every person that has Alzheimer's got to that place in the exact same way. And so their treatment becomes different. Very quick little snippet here at the end for those suffering from what they believe to be carpal tunnel problem here in the wrist and hand where the fingers are tingling, especially those people that are keyboarding all day long. And I don't mean playing the keyboards. I mean typing. You're at a keyboard, you're typing. Okay, that's keyboarding, right? That's what we called it in school. That shows you how old I am. All these young guys are looking at me like, we did not call it keyboarding. Okay. Well, we did. But if you're having issues with your fingertips and you can't feel them, well, one, your office might be way too freezing cold in the air-conditioned summer that we require around here, but you also could be low in a couple B vitamins. Thiamine, which is B1, pyridoxine, which is B6, and cobalamin, which is B12. These are all essential for myelin synthesis, meaning the layer of wrapped external component of the nerve. So that kind of insulating component on the outside of the nerve is made up of some of these B vitamins, or these B vitamins stimulate that portion of the nerve to regrow and regenerate. But it goes very, very slowly. If you've lost nerve connection over, say, 1 or 2 inches of space in your body, well, that signal's getting interrupted, therefore your fingertips may be getting numb, there may be compression in that carpal tunnel, and you have to look at the known mechanism there. Is there compression? Could it be relieved by chiropractic manipulation? Yes, it could be. Could it be helped with acupuncture? Yes, it could be. Or is it a B vitamin deficiency? Well, that's a simple blood test will tell us that answer. And so then for maybe 3-4 weeks, we treat it with all three of those things. And then as we slowly start to take away some of those different treatments, we see how long it can last and benefit the patient. And sometimes it's as simple as a couple of quick key wrist adjustments, or even looking at the neck. A lot of these nerves that come, well, all of the nerves that end up in your fingertips begin from the brain and the spine and leave through the little holes in your neck on the edge of each vertebral body. So if your fingers aren't working properly, you either have a neck issue. Stenosis would be the most common, where the holes are getting smaller, and that's where the nerve is beginning to be compressed. The problem could be in your shoulder, your elbow, your wrist, or actually right at the tip of the finger. So simple carpal tunnel needs to be addressed on a multitude of levels rather than just going through and cutting open that canal in a surgical sense. Some patients end up there. Not all will need to. All right, that's as good as I can do for today. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. You've been listening today to Dr. Andrew Dyer on AM 1290 and News 95.7 WHIO.